Movie, by the way, I was able to see it. I haven't seen the whole thing, but I've seen sneak previews and a special event with the producer, and it's really powerful. And it's like I'm thinking of Mel Gibson's movie on the Passion. Yeah, my brain went blank. It's The Passion of the Christ. Remember, it was rated R. Everybody thought that was going to kill it. This movie ended up with an R rating, and I suspect partly because the movie association that does these things wanted to kill it, but it's going to be up to us whether they succeed or not. Well, so now I'm going to get, everybody came up and I got several questions anticipating this talk, wanting me to give my talk in 5 minutes. I kept saying, okay, I'm going to talk about that in the next one. And so I'll just warn you ahead of time, I'm going to get kind of down into the philosophical foundations, but I promise this will not be nearly as painful as that may sound at the beginning. But if you notice when we were talking about, well, are machines going to replace us? There's this philosophical question that's buried just underneath the surface. Because for something to replace something else, literally, in every way, it would have to be the same kind of thing, right? Because if it's a fundamentally different kind of thing, that means they're going to have, one thing's going to have properties that the other one doesn't have, so it can't completely replace it, right? Or that thing would have to actually be more than the thing itself. And so there's actually an assumption built into almost the entire debate about artificial intelligence and robotics that almost no one ever actually really makes the argument for, and it's that man is a machine. And so think about this, right? So if you, probably most of you in this room, when you think about human beings, you think that we're creatures made in the image of God, and so of course we have bodies, we have physical needs, we're restrained and conditioned by time and place and the condition of our joints and our gastrointestinal state at any particular moment, right? So of course we are physical beings in that sense, but we're not merely physical beings. We're not purely, we can't be reduced to say the laws of physics and chemistry. And so you're going to probably think, well, I might be worried about evil robots, but you shouldn't think that machines are going to ultimately replace us, because we are more than machines. Now there are machine-like characteristics to our bodies, right? Levers, pumps, right? Your heart's literally a pump. The purpose and function of the heart is to pump blood, right? So that physically is a type of machine. On the other hand, it's not like any machine we've ever made. Think of the machines that we make. We take parts that are originally independent of each other, right? You take steel and you forge it and craft it and carve it into particular shapes, right? If you're going to make a watch or a rotary motor or something like that. Right from the outside, we put it together with our purposes. Think about what organisms do. Like you get a single-celled human embryo, you look at it, it's the size of a head of a pin, mostly undifferentiated, it looks simple. And yet somehow it unfolds itself, it starts splitting and differentiating, and somehow has the information and spatial coordinates to say the head goes here, the tail goes here, the gut goes here, right? It's nowhere visible. It unfolds from the inside out. All the parts are intimately related and interconnected. They all share the same DNA. This is so radically different than the types of machines that we can make. But the best we could say is that, okay, they're kind of little machine-like characteristics. But we should be utterly staggered by that capacity, which is completely beyond our capacity to make. Now, we talk about worries about artificial life and things like that, but I assure you that anything that a bioengineer does with an organic thing, right, or especially a living cell, they started with a living cell, right? We don't know how to get from literal chemistry to biology. You can take a single living cell, put it in a sterile solution, right? It's a living cell, and you puncture it. All the same ingredients are still there. The guts of the cell spill out and it dies. Now, if it was just the chemistry, it's all the stuff still there. Why is it dead? It's because the whole is much greater than the sum of its parts. That's true even of a single-celled organism like a bacterium. And if that's true of a bacterium or a rat, think how much more it is true of human beings who have bodies. We also have souls and spirits. We have agency. We have purpose and free will. But if you think that we are entirely the result of a blind and purposeless process, this impersonal process of random genetic mutations and natural selection impersonally sort of building slowly but surely these things that look designed but aren't really designed, and we've developed the capacity to build machines, we're still just machines, though. And in fact, we're machines that weren't even designed in a literal sense. This is what the robotics professor Marvin Minsky said. Our brains are just computers made of meat. And this materialistic idea, that's the prevalent idea of what the human person is in this whole discussion in technology and artificial intelligence. And so if you think that, you have reason to be worried, right? That human beings may be, rather than free creatures made in the image of God, we're just kind of a step in this blind process of cosmic evolution that started with the physical stage, and then it got to the chemical stage, and then it got to the biological stage. And right at the end of the biological stage, human beings emerged, and then human beings are right at the joint of the technological stage, right, of cosmic evolution, in which we end and technology takes over from here. That is the vision of transhumanism. That's the vision of this idea that machines are going to replace us, and so our choice is either going to be get left behind or wed ourselves, emerge ourselves, upload ourselves to our machines. That's transhumanism. It is based entirely on a prior philosophical assumption that we are machines. So if you ultimately want to combat it, you just have to understand that. That's what's happening. It's throughout the literature, and it's almost never debated, because the most powerful ideas are the ideas that are presupposed rather than argued for. Because then you're not aware of them, right? You just pick them up from your public school teacher. You just pick up the idea that, well, I mean, we choose our gender. It's not really related to our biological sex. And, you just sort of, the teachers treat that as if it's true, so you never actually hear any good philosophical arguments. You just pick it up. That's the same idea that we're machines. You just pick it up. It's actually really incoherent. Something that you'll discover about materialism is that it's always completely incoherent. That is, it has assumptions that contradict themselves. And the reason is because reality doesn't fit in the materialistic box. Materialism limits the types of ideas and things that a person is allowed to consider. And so you end up having to account for things on really, really implausible terms. So think about it. On the one hand, the Darwinist materialist is going to tell us we're just basically upright monkeys, right? We're just animals, right? It's all we are. And animals are actually not even really animals. They're just the result of these blind processes that go back to genes. And genes aren't really anything other than chemistry. And chemistry isn't really anything other than physics. And physics, turns out, isn't anything other than these physical laws. And, well, we'll just get fuzzy from there rather than explaining where the laws came from, right? That's on the one hand. On the other hand, we are these disembodied selves that are completely unconstrained by mammalian biology, right? And so you can wake up one day as a man with XY chromosomes and all the relevant man parts and decide by a sheer choice that you are a female. And then we're going to have a state, a government that's going to make you assent to that idea even if you don't buy it. Right? But that's only true if people are they're persons that are completely disconnected from their biology. But I thought we were nothing but biology a minute ago. And it turns out biology has no purchase on what we are. We're these disembodied cells, right? That just can sort of choose to be Napoleon or choose to be women. This is completely incoherent. Yet both of these ideas, if you go to any university, are going to be taught to you. This is, when you get self-contradiction like this, it's evidence that something's gone seriously wrong. That your worldview is completely out of keeping with ultimate reality. And so you will see this over and over and over again. You'll get the materialist in the sciences, and you'll get what you call this kind of expressive individualism in the humanities, in which people are in psychology and the soft sciences at the same time, right? Now that's just weird. So just remember that as the background. So my advice is that's stupid. So whatever's true, it's not going to be this. Anything that contradicts itself, you might not know what's true, but you know that that's got to be false. So here's the question. Are there sort of arguments, though? Like, could we give arguments that show that we're in fact really different from machines? I've already kind of given you the biological argument for how organisms, just any old organism, any old living organism, the simplest you can pick out, a fungus, or a bacterium, is radically greater than any machine that we can devise. there's a philosopher, but what about artificial intelligence? So I'm kind of talking about two things here at once. Robotics has to do with building machines that can do things in time and space, much like we can do, right? And so most of the robots that you see are sort of one-job robots, like a single mounted arm. You look at the videos for the Amazon installment or fulfillment centers are just remarkable feats of automation, in which they're almost entirely automated. The forklifts aren't driven by anyone. Somebody just programs, okay, go get this product. It finds the pallet. It takes the pallet. It moves it. All this stuff is done by machines, robots, and computers, artificial intelligence, right? And at the very end of the process, there are lone carbon units, lone humans, right, that take the stuff from the pallet and put it in boxes. Now, why don't they have a robot arm that can do that? Did you know that? We've not yet developed a robot arm that can tell the difference between a roll of toilet paper and a bottle of wine and silly putty and popcorn in a bag. But every three-year-old has the ability to do that. So we haven't even developed robotic arms that can do that, right? And it's because the computational resources, what's happening when you pick up a glass, right, and pour something into it, is you're constantly getting feedback. You know, okay, about how hard it is, so you know how much pressure to apply, you feel the weight, right? You know where to put the bottle so that it falls. You know how hard that is. There's 1,000 things going on there. So much so that even Amazon, in its almost purely automated fulfillment centers, doesn't yet have robotic arms that can discern the differences in those things. Now, we'll eventually get there. But don't overestimate robotics, because in fact, there's stuff even that we do with our bodies that's very, very hard. But there's this kind of other side of things, and that's artificial intelligence. And that's just building systems that act as if they are intelligent. Now, every one of you encounters this every single day. The best AI that we have at the moment is the Google search. At least the best AI that we encounter is that Google search algorithm. I assure you, if you took somebody from the 1950s, set them down at a computer and said, if you can type on this thing and you can type a question into this box, right? And they started typing it and it auto-filled and anticipated the rest of their question. And they clicked on it and it found exactly what they were looking for. They would assume, okay, there's a bank of people answering questions somewhere, right? Probably in a basement. That is artificial intelligence. Now, nobody thinks that because we know how it works, right? We know that what's happening with the Google algorithm is that there's a program that's constantly culling the information of actual choices of people. There are billions and billions of choices in which you have chosen, okay, here's my question, and then you matched it with the best answer. And then this program records that. And so it gets better and better and better, not on its own, but as a result of all the choices of all these free agents. That's how artificial intelligence works. But the system itself is not conscious. It is not an agent. It is not thinking about what it's doing. And there is no more reason to think that a computer, if it gets fast enough, will become conscious than to think that a tractor, if it gets strong enough, will become an ox. They're just fundamentally different things. It's not what's happening. It's not what's happening inside these machines. And so, yes, we are going to develop more and more seemingly intelligent systems called weak artificial intelligence. But it does not follow that we're ever going to have strong artificial intelligence. Strong artificial intelligence is where machines are just like we are. They're literally conscious agents, first-person perspective, making choices. That's the mistake that people make. Now, if you're a materialist, here's how this goes. If you read How to Create a Mind by Ray Kurzweil, big, thick book, or The Singularity is Near, here's how the argument will go. Well, we're nothing but machines, and we eventually got to a level of complexity that we, for some reason, just became conscious, right? And so if that happened, there's no reason to think that our machines won't do that at some point. And they'll tell us they're conscious, and we'll just have to believe them. That's literally his argument. Right? It's literally his argument. Now, there's a philosopher named John Searle, I'll talk about in a minute, who has just been apoplectic with anger and frustration at how bad this argument is. But that's literally Ray Kurzweil's argument. Well, they'll just seem conscious, and so we'll have to assume they are. And then when you say, but just because something seems conscious doesn't mean it is, you know what the move is? Well, then, who's to say we're conscious? we're just machines. Maybe that's an illusion. I'm not making this up. I'm going to give you quotes. I'm going to give you the actual quotes of officially smart people. So Searle, starting in the 80s, John Searle is still alive. He's a prominent analytic philosopher at the University of California, Berkeley. He's one of these rare birds. He's not an atheist exactly, but he's certainly not a Christian or a theist, sort of an agnostic, politically conservative. And he sort of made it his life's mission to destroy this argument. And you developed an argument called the Chinese room argument to just show that what computers are doing is different from what persons are doing. So here, this is actually a sketch that looks like Searle. He's had these big 1970s sideburns since the 70s and still has them. And so here's the idea. Okay, let's say that there's a person and you're trapped in a room, right? And you have a bunch of cards here and you have a bunch of cards here. All the cards have Chinese scripts and symbols on them. And you don't know a lick of Chinese. In fact, maybe you don't even know that they're Chinese, right? And you have a rule book that tells you if this symbol comes through the left slot, the slot on the left side of the room, then find the card that has this symbol and put it in the slot on the right side of the room. And then you just follow the rules, all right? And so it starts happening. Cards start coming in the left. You take it and you look at the image, and then you're just playing a game of matching. You see it and it says, okay, I've got this card. I need to give this card into the right slot, right? So do you see what's happening? Cards are coming in on one side. You follow the rules, and then you put the card on the other end. Now, do you know what's going on? So imagine that what's happening is that two Chinese speakers are standing outside the room. They're actually communicating with each other, right? And you've got a system of rules that turns out sort of conforms to grammar. And you're following the rules, and let's say you follow them perfectly, right? And so these two men, these two Chinese men that know Chinese, are communicating with each other, right? But you don't have any idea what's going on. All right, that you in the Chinese room are just exactly like the computer. You're working at what technically would be called the level of syntax. Syntax is the system of formal rules, but not the level of semantics or meaning. You in the Chinese room do not know what these symbols mean. And in the same way, in fact, you're better off than the computer, because at least you know, I don't know what any of this means, right? It's just kind of frustrating and boring. The computer can't even do that. The computer is following rules that have been either laid down or developed in terms of a machine learning algorithm, but it doesn't know the meaning of any of those things. In fact, the programs only have meaning because there are agents involved getting them to do things. All right. Now, this argument has gone through several. You can just Google Chinese room at Wikipedia, and you can see just the kind of the chaos this argument has created for decades. Because if you understand this argument and you're not a deeply committed materialist, you realize the gig is completely up once you get this. This just completely demolishes the strong AI argument, which is that, well, something can seem intelligent and therefore it must be intelligent. No, this guy's just following the rules, but he has no idea what the meaning of any of the symbols are. All right, and so you just, it's delightful, and because I write about this stuff, I get to read the literature to watch the materialist writhe in anger trying to get around this argument. And it shows sort of no signs. Here's actually just sort of another picture of the basic scenario, right? You see the people talking outside. And so this tells us that whatever is happening inside machines, it isn't about agents, intelligent beings, transferring meaning from one to the other. It's not, what's happening is not what's happening right now. You all know English. I'm speaking English. You're generally kind of, if you haven't drifted off and thinking about March Madness, right? You're following what I'm saying, right? Because of meaning. And so one agent, it's so weird. So I'm an agent, and I'm translating what I mean to say into sounds, and then there are waves going through the air, and they're hitting your ear, and they're going into your brain, and you're interpreting them, and you're sharing the same meaning. I'm communicating this meaning to you. Nothing like this is happening in computers. It's just not. That's just not what's happening. Some of you may remember Watson, who was the IBM supercomputer that beat the world's remaining champions in Jeopardy in 2011. And I wrote about this at the time. Because, of course, everybody panicked. Oh, no, you know, machines are waking up. But if you talk to David Ferrucci, who is the project manager at IBM, like, that's not what's happening. It had a bunch of databases and servers, and so it would just sort of connect words together and then run statistics and say, okay, when this word connects with this word connects with this word, more often than not, it connects to this word. And then it would run a probability, and then it says, okay, well, the answer has a 93% probability of being this, and then it would just shoot up the answer. This is not conscious, right? It's doing what it's supposed to do, and it's really fast at doing it. But from the outside, you're seeing Watson answer questions in 2/1000ths of a second, and everybody just kind of freaks out. So it's very important for us to understand what's happening here. It's going to be more important every day because AI is going to get better and better and better. It's going to get closer and closer, and more closely approximate many of the things we do. But there is absolutely no reason to think that those things are ever going to be what we are, right? We are designing them to do that. Just as we design a wheelbarrow, right, to carry things more efficiently than we can carry on our own, on our backs, or we can script horses and ox to carry things more efficiently, we make machines that can do searches, for instance, far quicker and more efficiently. It's not anything fundamentally different than what we've ever done when we built technology. So if you are aware of the fact that we can communicate meaning, you already understand why machines, we're not machines, and machines aren't going to become us. Let me give you another one, all right? So I know I have just vastly increased the likelihood of you eating ice cream this afternoon, right? It's Lent, too. I'm like, oh, I should have changed this. But all right, so I want you to do this. So close your eyes, and I want you to think about ice cream. I put a picture up there because that conforms to my image of ice cream. I always think about strawberry and then vanilla and chocolate like this. And so you're thinking about it, all right? Okay, you're thinking about ice cream in your mind's eye. Now, what has happened? What's just happened? Notice that you assumed a bunch of things, right? That one simple act. First, you're a person. You have first-person perspective. You're thinking about ice cream. It's about something. So yeah, there's something going on in your brain. If we were to do a real-time MRI scan, and I said, okay, think about ice cream, there would be a pattern that you could see, a physical electric pattern, electrochemical pattern. So something is happening in your brain, right? But it's not the same as you thinking about ice cream, right? That pattern in your brain isn't about anything. Right, whereas the thought is about ice cream. And that's kind of the essence of what it is to have a first-person perspective. You're seeing it, right? When you something is red, we can define red in terms of the wavelength in the electromagnetic spectrum. That's not the same thing as experiencing the color red. This is what philosophers call qualia. Those are just two different things, even if they're somehow related. So that means you have thoughts, right? And the essence of thoughts is this kind of aboutness. Right, so I'm getting you deep into philosophy of mind here. But this is the sort of basic idea. One of the properties that thoughts have that chemical reactions don't have is that chemical reactions aren't about things. Thoughts are about things. All right? And so what that means is because thoughts are about things, they have a property that no physical object or pattern or reaction has. So they must be different. Now, don't get tricked. People will say, but if we were to analyze your brain, we would see chemical reactions and patterns. Yes, that's true. They connect with that, and they relate to it in some way, right? But they're not the same thing. You're assuming you have reasons. So in other words, you're able to listen. Okay, he said ice cream, and he wants me to think about it. I know what that means. That means I need to think about it, and ice cream is this particular object. So you have this capacity both to listen and to reason from particular things to particular conclusions. I, of course, asked you to think about ice cream, right? And then you freely did so based on my request, right? So whatever chemical reaction was happening in your brain, it didn't cause you to think about ice cream. What caused you to think about ice cream is me asking you to do it, and you probably did it automatically. It's kind of that way with ice cream, but you kind of had to freely say, okay, I'm going to concentrate on it, and so your will came in at that point. But the causation went from me suggesting it, you hearing it, understanding it, something happening in your brain, right? So notice that the thing happening in your brain didn't cause the thought. The you deciding to have the thought caused the thing to happen in your brain. That's absolutely essential. Because that is impossible and unthinkable for the materialist. It makes absolutely no sense. And so that's why I say in six, those thoughts cause something to happen in your brain and elsewhere in your body. So in other words, meaning, an agent telling you things and asking you to do things having to do with thoughts cause things in the physical world to happen. So there's an immaterial realm of purposes and ideas and agents that is able to actually affect things in the physical world. Now you should see why that's just completely crazy if you're a materialist. But you know that you did this. And if we were a room full of materialists, you would have all done the same thing. But you have to figure out a way of explaining it away. I had an argument with a guy just last weekend who insisted that, no, you don't actually cause that to happen. There's some subconscious thing that's causing the ice cream to happen. And he was arguing with me. I said, well, if that's the case, why are you arguing with me? Because you're clearly trying to persuade me of something, right? You seem to think, he never got it. He never got it. Fortunately, 20 people were listening, and they all got the point. He never got it. He was so deeply embedded in this. This is the materialist dead end to which the commanding heights of our culture are in. This is an intellectual cul-de-sac, right? And the commanding heights, that is the most influential parts of our culture, universities and think tanks, buy into this and must deny all of those things. And they do, in fact, deny it. They deny that you're a person with a first-person perspective. They deny that you have thoughts that are about things. They deny that you have reason. They deny there's no person, and so somebody can't be asking you to do that. You can't do it freely because everything you do is determined by the laws of physics. And immaterial things can't cause things to happen in the material world. That's crazy, right? Even though they're all doing it and know it more directly than they could possibly know some philosophical argument for materialism. So they're denying the thing that everybody knows directly in favor of some theory that they picked up because they read too much Richard Dawkins or had a professor who had read Richard Dawkins. Now, you might think nobody is so crazy but to deny these things. So I just very briefly want to prove it to you that I'm not talking about fringe characters. B.F. Skinner is the founder of the behaviorist school of philosophy, which reigned for decades in the 1950s and 1960s. You remember the Skinner boxes. He said, well, there aren't really persons and agents inside. Everything's just determined by these kind of external behaviors. And so we can completely change people's very being by just modifying their behavior, kind of zapping them when they do one thing, giving them a little pellet of food when they do another. There's nothing inside. He wrote a book called Beyond Freedom and Dignity. And here's what he said. Autonomous man, that is a person, right, that can actually do things on its own, has been constructed from our ignorance. And as our understanding increases, the very stuff of which he's composed vanishes. The same man qua man, that is man as man, we readily say good riddance. Only by dispossessing him can we turn to the real causes of human behavior. Only then can we turn from the inferred to the observed, from the miraculous to the natural, from the inaccessible to the manipulable. That's Skinner. Then we can fully control and manipulate these things once we get rid of this idea that they're persons making choices. Right? The most influential person in psychology for a good part of the 20th century. Not a fringe idea. What is agency? What is freedom? I'm talking about agency, but it requires something minimal. It doesn't require that you're just this disembodied soul. And we clearly aren't. That's contrary to the Christian doctrine of the human person as this unique hybrid of material and spiritual. The dust of the earth and the breath of God. So we're shaped by our upbringing, by our genes, by our environment, by our parents. It's all a part of what we are. It both limits us and gives us particular potential. So think of that as the nature and the nurture, as shaping. But at the same time, there's an agent in there that is able to make choices that aren't determined by genes and environment. You still have this capacity. Right? Now, this makes perfect sense of the Christian view of the human person. It's also what everybody assumes about him or herself. Right? Everyone assumes they have this ability. Your professor might be a materialist and tell you you actually don't have freedom. If you slit his tires, he will respond as if he thinks you're morally guilty and culpable. Right? So you know it even if you deny it. The man under materialism, though, this is all there is. Nature and nurture. And it turns out, if you read carefully enough, nurture ends up being nature. And nature ends up being this blind and purposeless system that doesn't exist for any purpose and isn't going anywhere. There's no freedom or agency. Bertrand Russell, one of the most prominent philosophers, British philosophers of the 20th century, is talking about freedom. This idea that, you know, we can sort of freely choose things and then be held responsible for it. He said, when a man acts in ways that annoy us, we wish to think him wicked, and we refuse to face the fact that his annoying behavior is the result of antecedent causes, as causes that came before, which, if you follow them long enough, will take you beyond the moment of his birth and therefore to events for which he cannot be held responsible by any stretch of the imagination. So if you're a man and you say, abuse women, right, our sense would be to say, well, you're responsible and should be punished for that. No, no, no. If you look at the way male chimpanzees treat female chimpanzees, this is just programmed into his genes. That is literally what Russell is saying. Long before you ever existed, You are already programmed to do this, and so you can't be held. This idea of moral responsibility is based on freedom, and freedom is an illusion. It can't possibly exist. Materialism, no reason. Darwin was actually acutely aware of this in his own theory, in The Descent of Man. He realized, okay, if we're not made in the image of God with kind of moral culpability and the rational God who creates us to have reason, that's sort of worrisome, right? Here's how he put it. He said, with me, the horrid doubt always arises whether the conviction of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, or are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust in the convictions of a monkey's mind if there were any convictions in such a mind? And if that's all we are, why trust your convictions? But then, wait, why trust your conviction that your theory is true? Right? Because that's also a conviction, this idea that we're the result of this blind, long process. Right? That's a theoretical belief. So why believe that your own theory is true if that story is true? So again, materialism ends up hoisting itself on its own petard. Because natural selection, if you think about how natural selection works, what natural selection does is it selects for present survival value. Right? And so think of ancient humans, right? And they're in a tribe. And so there's one set, it's one tribe that when it sees lions, right, it runs toward lions, thinking, oh, they're cute kitties, I'm going to run toward them, right? And others that think, oh, well, I want them to chase me, and so I'll run away. Right, now, neither of those beliefs make sense, right? They really should think they're dangerous, so I should run away. But the ones that falsely believe, oh, I want to play with them, so I'll run away, natural selection will select for that behavior, right? Because that tribe's going to end up outliving the lions more likely than the ones that run toward the lions. Does that make sense? And so all natural selection can do is select for behaviors that confer survival on a population. Natural selection can't pick from an infinite variety of possible true and false beliefs and pick the true one. So Patricia Churchland at MIT, it's a little salty, but I don't think we have too many young kids here. Here's how she puts it. She said, boiled down to essentials, the nervous system enables the organism to succeed in the four Fs, feeding, fleeing, fighting, and reproducing. The principal choices of the four Fs, by the way, is the term in evolutionary psychology. The principal chore of nervous systems is to get the body parts where they should be in order that the organism may survive. Improvements in sensory motor control confer an evolutionary advantage. A fancier style of representing and representing an is advantageous so long as it's geared to the organism's way of life and enhances the organism's chances of survival. Truth, whatever that is, definitely takes the hindmost. So there's no reason to believe if we're purely the result of blind natural selection, selecting for survival-enhancing behavior, for us to trust our beliefs or to trust that we even have reason. We might be thinking things in our heads, but they don't actually relate to the behaviors that have allowed natural selection to preserve us. Now, there's a very sophisticated knockdown, drag-out, ironclad argument for this point by a Christian philosopher named Alvin Plantinga. Calls it the evolutionary argument against naturalism, and I'm not gonna spend a lot of time on it. I'm gonna show it to you, but don't panic. And we're not gonna. This is what it sort of looks like. It's based on this is the probability given R, the sort of truth of our reason given naturalism, that is materialism, and Darwinian evolution is low. That's what this means. You don't need to worry about it. But the conclusion is that if Darwinian theory and materialism or naturalism are both true, then it's not rational for us to trust our reason. It's highly unlikely that our reason is not reliable. We should trust that we're going to do things that generally confer survival on the species, and that's all. And you kind of think of this non-technically just by thinking of the Darwinian backstory. So here's the basic story. Don't think about the time scales. Don't think about the kind of general history of life. You need to think about this in Darwinian terms. So you might think, okay, well, God could be guiding this process. But that's not the Darwinian story. The Darwinian story is that you start out with chemistry and for some lucky accident, you get a reproducing molecule, right? And that reproducing molecule survives for a few billion years and it reproduces. And then somehow it differentiates and you get multicellular organisms. And then, you know, 550 million years ago or so, you started getting animal life and complex large life, right? And you got these large reptiles and you eventually got mammals. And then right at the very end of this process, of 4.5 billion years, you get humans who have beliefs about things like theories. Right? Now, for billions of years, did the beliefs of the bacteria make any difference to its survival advantage? Of course not. Right? I don't know where the beliefs started. I don't know, maybe do monkeys have beliefs? I don't know. But clearly, the Darwinian process was working for billions and billions of years, and only at the very end did beliefs pop up. So given that if that's true, it's much more likely to think that beliefs is just some weird thing that our brains pop up. But they don't really have anything to do with the external world. This is what materialism gets you. This is where consistent materialists go. But they want to use reason to argue you into the truth of the theory, which they have no reason to trust. Right? That's the paradox. And finally, they say that actually thinking isn't really about things. Right? There's a book called The Atheist Guide to Reality by a guy named Alex Rosenberg. Now, you're thinking he's in his pajamas writing on the internet. He is a professor of philosophy at Duke University in North Carolina. And here's what he says in that book. The notion that thoughts are about stuff is illusory. Think of each input-output neural circuit as a single still photo. Now, put together a huge number of input-output circuits in the right way. None of them is about anything. Each is just an input-output circuit firing or not. You see what's happened? He's just assuming that we are machines. Input-output circuits firing. No person, no choices, no ideas about anything. But he's writing a book in which he puts his ideas down and wants to communicate these ideas to someone else. This happens every time. And if you realize what's going on, you realize this is a game. And these people don't even understand what they're saying. This is how bad it's gotten. So in some ways, the 21st century is the best time in the world to be alive if you're a Christian, right? Because it's sort of like Stephen Hawking near the end of his life said, because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing, right? So he couldn't say the universe has always existed because we know that's not true. They don't want to talk about an eternal God. So instead he says, a thing that didn't exist and it doesn't exist, so it can't have properties, it can't have causal powers, caused itself to come into existence. Well, that's about the worst part. If that's your only alternative, right, have at it, right? But that's at this point, we've got a really strong argument on our side. And if you're actually at the point where you have to say nobody actually has ideas or thoughts about anything, and they're going to use thoughts and ideas to try to argue you into that, logically and intellectually, we're in the much stronger position. What always, always happens with materialism, including this materialism that's a part of the kind of AI revolution, you know, this idea that machines are going to become us, and it's suicidal reasoning, is that you're sawing off the branch that you're sitting on. That's what the materialist, right, who tells you, uses reason to tell you that we can't possibly have reason is telling you, right? Or tries to get you to think of something and use your agency freely to tell you you don't have freedom, right? He's sawing off the very basis on which he argues. So there is absolutely no reason for us to concede the assumption that so many assume but don't want to defend, that man is a machine. What we should do is just avoid suicidal reasoning and conclude man is not a machine but more than a machine. Thank you very much.